Please, yes.
Okay, well, first, thanks for inviting me to this program. I'm enjoying it here. So I'll be talking about some of my research on radiative turbulence. And so this is work that I've been doing over the course of this year mostly. And I should acknowledge my collaborators. They're all in Colorado, and they were involved heavily in this work. Okay, so turbulence, I think, in the relativistic regime is a very exciting topic right now. So I'll start by giving a brief overview of recent results, just in general. Then I'll be talking about radiative turbulence in pair plasmas. And if there's time, radiative turbulence in electron ion plasmas. And I suspect there won't be time, but we'll try. So here are the motivations for this kind of understanding this kind of turbulence. So this all falls into high-energy astrophysics. Turbulence is, of course, ubiquitous, as we saw in the slides just now, for example, and it occurs in many different systems. And here are some different examples of systems where turbulence may be driven. You may get a supernova remnants like Kepler's supernova there. You could get pulsar wind nebulae like the Crab Nebula, which is a very famous example of a big pair plasma, which is relativistically hot. You get jets, as it was just shown, and also the radio lobes at the end of jets. These are thought to be possibly relativistic pair plasmas. Or maybe relativistic electron ion plasmas. I think that's still up to debate. Accretion flows, such as in M87 or in the center of the Milky Way, you don't really see the turbulence in these images, but it's I guarantee you it's there. And also, intracluster medium is another example. So, in all these systems, you have at least some relativistic components there, radiation, and they're all collisionless. Understanding the turbulence there in the inertial range and at small scales is important for understanding the structure and spectra of the radiation. And so I don't think this audience needs too much motivation, but I'll just give you one example of a particular system where collisionless plasma physics is thought to be very important. And these are radiatively inefficient accretion flows, or thick disks around black holes, both supermassive, like in the center of a galaxy, and also stellar mass, like in X-ray binary systems. So what's known about these systems is that well, first of all, they're thought to be just these very hot collisionless flows onto black holes. And there's expected to be a lot of plasma physics involved. The radiation spectra indicate a highly non-thermal population of electrons spanning orders of magnitude and energy. And here are some examples of what the radiation spectra for these systems look like. That's one thing that's known about these systems. Another thing is that global models indicate that you need a two-temperature plasma in which the ions are much hotter than the electrons in order to prevent the collapse of these flows into thin collisional accretion disks, which would have qualitatively different properties. So that's another plasma physics features in these systems that need to be described. Finally, there's also rapid X-ray flares, which are occasionally observed, not all the time, intermittently, but there's a lot of evidence for these. For example, you look at a light curve of the high energy photons in one of these systems, you can see there's some background fluctuations and then spikes at certain times due to these flares. So since this is expected to be a very turbulent system, turbulence is driven by the magnetorotational instability. The question is our knowledge of turbulence sufficient to explain these kinds of properties? That's kind of one of the motivations for this kind of work. So what is relativistic turbulence? What am I exactly talking about? Well, there are two senses in which relativity comes in. First, you might have a relativistic plasma where the temperature is much larger than the rest mass of the particles. And this is what this theta parameter is. If that's much larger than one, then it's a relativistic plasma or relativistically hot. And this also means that the mean Lorentz factor of the particles is much larger than one. So that's one way in which the particle may be relativistic, in which relativity comes in. The other way is through relativistic turbulence, and this is determined by a sigma parameter, which is called the magnetization. This is defined as the ratio of the magnetic energy density to the enthalpy, relativistic enthalpy of the plasma. And in the limit of a hot relativistically hot plasma, the relativistic enthalpy is given here. It's basically the rest mass of the particles plus their kinetic energy, their thermal energy. And when you have sigma larger than one, the energy is dominated by the magnetic energy. Particle energy becomes subdominant. And that means that the motions, which are alphanic, become close to the speed of light. So the bulk flows become relativistic. And that's what I call relativistic turbulence. And so I'll be talking about both of these today. They're kind of, in some sense, combined. Okay, and so that's what relativistic turbulence is. And this is all for a collisionless plasma, of course. So motivations for studying this, as I just mentioned, high-energy astrophysics, a whole alphabet is in this regime. It's an unexplored frontier of turbulence, so it's intellectually exciting for that reason. It's a prototypical theoretical problem in the sense that non-thermal particles are expected to be energized in these systems. And then it's finally viable with first principles particle and cell simulations, as I'll show. And broadly speaking, you could ask about two questions in two categories, the statistical properties of the turbulence and what are the kinetic properties of the particles. So the first question involves cascades, anisotropy, things like that. Second is involving non-thermal particles. And, I'll be focusing on the second of those.
Just a question. So can we think about this delta V as bulk flow velocities? Is that true?
Yeah, that's the sense that I mean it here. So it's like some RMS flow velocity. Yeah. Okay, and so now I'll just put up a list of things that are known about relativistic kinetic turbulence. And all of these numerical results are from the last 2 years or so, so they're quite new results. So the first of these is that three-dimensional and two-dimensional pair plasma simulations appear to reproduce MHD inertial range. And I'll just show an example from one of my simulations of a relativistically hot pair plasma. First, here's an animation of the current density in one of these boxes. So this is a three-dimensional simulation, and I'm just taking different slices in one of the boxes going through there. So time is just the out-of-plane coordinate in the box. You see a lot of turbulence, a lot of current sheets there. On the right, you see the density fluctuations in the plasma. And you also see a lot of large-scale, obviously, turbulent structures spanning a broad range of scales. So all of this doesn't look too different from MHD. You can see there's a lot of scale separation.
How large are those density fluctuations relative to the mean density?
So it depends on the magnetization. And in this case, I would say it's probably like 30% or so. With higher magnetization, it'll be larger.
This is driven?
Yeah, so these are driven. But then Luca has done simulations of decaying turbulence, and it looks in some sense pretty similar, I would say.
Is blue negative on this plot?
Let's see. Blue is positive density, so these are actually over densities down here. Yeah.
And how is it driven?
Driven with an oscillating Langevin antenna. Yeah. So electromagnetically driven. Okay, so that's qualitatively what it looks like. Quantitatively, we do see some kind of inertial range here. Here's my simulations on the left, the magnetic energy spectrum compensated by K to the 5/3 Kolmogorov scaling, and we see flat region over a factor of a few, which indicates that we get some inertial range, and this is converged with the system size. And also, Columbia group, led by Luca Comiso and Lorenzo Cerroni, have also done similar simulations, also see inertial range. So I would say it's pretty clear at this point that these simulations reproduce something which looks like an MHD inertial range, at least to first order. And so we're able to get the scale separation necessary for that, which I think is quite important. You could see there's also another range here at scales below the gyro radius of the particles. And the spectrum steepens in this range to something like k to the minus 4. It's not really known what causes this cascade, or if it's even a power law or some exponential. There are some ideas in the non-relativistic turbulence community. It could be kinetic cascade, like an entropy cascade, but I would say at this point that it's not really known.
Is it thinking critical balance as well?
Yeah, and we have evidence of critical balance. It's in this paper right here.
Yeah. But you're not talking about the some longer scales.
No, at the MHD range. Yeah. Okay, and so the unknown is the nature of the kinetic range cascade. So what else is known? Well, it's known that we get efficient particle acceleration in relativistic turbulence. So I've shown this for driven turbulence. As I mentioned, the Columbia group and then the soon-to-be Columbia group showed this for decaying turbulence. And then, for example, Paolo has also had very nice work which showed this for the kink instability, which maybe isn't fully developed turbulence, but sees similar results there. So I thought I should mention it there. So what do these non-thermal particles look like? Well, here's my simulation again. We start with a thermal distribution, and then as you evolve it in time, you get this very long power law tail in the particle energy. So gamma here is the Lorentz factor, just the energy over the rest mass of the particles. And this extends to the highest energies possible in the sense that particle gyro radius at these energies up here becomes comparable to the driving scale, and so you can't accelerate them anymore once they get to that point. So that's a pretty efficient particle acceleration. And this depends on the magnetization. As we increase the magnetization, we get harder distributions, close to a minus 2 index here. Okay.
So is this true for the decaying turbulence as well?
Yes, and so here's Luca's work, just to highlight what he's done. And he'll be talking more about this on Thursday, I guess. He's done very large two-dimensional and three-dimensional decaying turbulence simulations, and he sees very similar distributions develop, also going to the system size limit. And since these go to much larger system sizes in two dimensions, it confirms that particle acceleration happens at the large system sizes. Okay. So that's one note. This is what's known. The power law index hardens with increasing magnetization, and it appears to converge with system size. Although I'm going to put an asterisk there, because we suggested in one of our papers that there's a system size dependent formation time. The larger system size, you need to wait longer for the power law to fully develop due to what ends up being like the larger number of scatterings to accelerate the particles required to get them to the highest energies. And then also I should say that the simulation sizes are still quite limited in some sense, so I wouldn't really say the door is completely closed on this.
Can you just comment briefly on what determines the maximum energy? Does it scale with system size or what?
Yeah, so far it seems like it scales with system size. The larger box, the longer range of energies you get, the higher energy particles you get. Yeah.
What's the smallest sigma you've tried?
You went down
still get
it. Yeah, our published results, I think, go to sigma of a quarter or So not really too low. But then we've done simulations well below that, and then it takes a long time to form the power law in that case. And I would say we could get easily -4, -5 for the index. Yeah.
So when you converge the power law for large system sizes, then what is that power law? Is it?
It depends on sigma. And so for sigma, for sigma of 1/2, which is a case we focused on in this paper, it's an index of -3. Yeah, but higher sigma will give a harder distribution.
So do you know why it takes longer for low sigma to get a power?
Yes, and I'll get to that soon. First let me mention. Another interesting result is all the other stuff was for pair plasmas, but we've also done some electron ion plasmas. And we find that the ions are preferentially heated and accelerated, at least for the plasma betas of order unity. And just to show one highlight of this, we're focusing here on the transrelativistic regime, where the temperatures are between the electron and ion rest masses. And so you get ultra-relativistic electrons and sub-relativistic ions. In this regime, the scale separation between electrons and ions is actually set by the temperature of the ions relative to their rest mass. And basically, the separation between the gyro radii goes as theta to the 1/2. So as we vary this theta parameter at high theta, both species are relativistic, and it looks like a pair plasma, and this is expected theoretically and mathematically. As we decrease this theta, the ions become subrelativistic, and we see preferential ion heating in that case. We get to the point where, in the limit where the electrons are becoming close to non-relativistic, we get about 90% of the dissipated energy going into the ions. We have an empirical formula to describe this, and it's shown here. Basically, this energy partition versus the ratio of the gyro radii to the 2/3 power seems to describe this energy partition very, very well in these simulations. Paolo, did you have a question?
I had a quick question. So, when you talk about the heating here, do you still see power laws in both the ions and electrons, or do you also see just heating, just not so?
Yeah, so we see power laws in both species still. The electron power law becomes steeper than the ion power law, so the ions are more efficiently accelerated. And it turns out that the energy that goes into the non-thermal ions is kind of proportional to this energy partition, actually.
So for driven turbulence in PIG, you're cooling the system somehow, right? Or you are not?
No, we're just, so I'll be talking about cooling later in the talk, but in these cases, it's no cooling, so the energy just accumulates in the box.
Are they increased, by a large number compared to the initial energy?
It depends on how long we run the simulation and on sigma. So if it's high sigma or if we run for a long time, then we could get a factor of a few increase in the energy. Yeah.
But does that affect the partition?
The partition, you're asking, is this time dependent, basically?
Yeah, so your sigma, right, so you're putting in more energy than initially begin with, so your sigma would change in some way.
Yep, it decreases in time. Yep.
It decreases by a factor of few.
Yeah. Yep.
So you are gradually moving towards a lower sigma system, and you still get power laws.
That's right. Once the power law is there, it stays. It doesn't get steeper after time. If you get a hard power law, then it stops evolving, basically. Yes, for these simulations, it ran like 5 or 6 Alphane times, so it's not long enough to see too much time dependence in it. In principle, that is an issue, though.
Yeah.
mass ratio be running?
This isn't a real mass ratio, but the electrons are effectively heavy because of their relativistic. Yeah. Okay, so unknowns are the effects of other parameters. What happens when you get to subrelativistic temperatures? And I mean more subrelativistic than these ions are right now. What happens with a strong guide field, especially in three dimensions? Maybe other parameters as well. So those are still open to debate. And the other thing that's known is that the mechanism of acceleration seems to be consistent with gyroresonant scattering by Alphenic modes, although magnetic reconnection may play a role at high magnetization, as shown by Luca. And so let me just show a couple of slides on this. So going back to this big simulation that I showed for a pair plasma, this shows the highest the particles which gain the highest energy in over the course of the simulation. And it shows how these energies evolve in time. And you can see they're kind of randomly kicked up in energy until they reach the cutoff at the highest energies. Basically, what's shown here in the black dashed line is the expectation you get from a Fermi-like mechanism of acceleration, where the particles gain energy proportional to the energy they already have, and gives them an exponential increase in time. Once you take into account time dependence of parameters, it becomes somewhat sub-exponential, but it's close to exponential. The acceleration time for a Fermi-like process or for gyroresonance scattering is shown here. And this is what we plug into this fit here, and it seems to describe the acceleration pretty well.
So physically, this is Alphine modes in the inertial range,
yes,
interacting gyroresonantly with high-energy particles.
Indeed.
Yep. So do we interpret the power law as related to the 5/3? Oh no, because it changes the magnetization. So how do you predict the power law?
Well, it's unclear if the turbulent, if the magnetic energy spectrum changes with sigma. I think that's pretty close to 5/3 always. I think in these works, what's more important is actually the parallel spectrum, which goes like k parallel to the -2. And I think that's how you interpret, that's the index which sets this.
Oh,
scattering.
It eventually gets to that at really high magnetization, and there's some limiting process that stops it reaching that at low magnetization. Is that what you mean?
Well, we haven't really looked at the connection to the spectrum very carefully, but I could tell you that the particles, once they get to these energies, they're interacting with, they're at scales in the inertial range.
Sure.
So, yeah, connecting it with index of the turbulent spectrum, I think, is a little bit unclear at this point.
Can you remind us why the energy gain is proportional to the energy points to second order? Couldn't it also be first? This same argument has been used for first order.
True, it could also be first order. Next slide, I guess, so show that it's second order.
Can you explain the acceleration of time form?
Well, I guess there are a few ways you could get this. You could get from gyroresonance scattering, which is a little bit complicated. It's done in like quasi-linear calculations in these works, for example. L is it's a scattering mean free path, and in our case, that seems to be driving scale of the turbulence, and so this L is just the size of the box in our case.
So the particles really fly L before they get.
Yeah, they're just weakly scattered by the fluctuations in like pitch angle. Yeah.
But I mean, in our case, for the reconnection problem, we get exactly that relationship, but it can be positive and negative because depending on whether your Alphanic kink is going one direction versus the other, the energy can go down as the particle scatters off. And so maybe that's why you're getting second order. You see what I mean?
interesting.
If you have a Alphaic kink, okay, so here we are, a kink. It's flowing this way, a particle coming in will gain energy. Mm-hmm. If you have a kink, which is going backwards, the particle will go in and lose energy. And so that thing will be negative. So you have positive and negative contributions. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why you're getting second order. Because the left-hand equation, if that's positive everywhere, you would expect it would be first
order. Yeah, that would be first order. But this is just for the highest energy. I'm interpreting this just for the highest energy particles. Yeah. And they end up just being the luckiest, getting successively the positive kicks. Yeah.
Well, the expression for gamma being exponential time seems that tau acceleration is time independent.
Yeah, but the fit I use here is actually correcting for the fact that sigma is changing in time, and sigma is giving you this.
If it's changing in time, then the solution is not going to be exponential.
Right, it would be a power law, actually. Yeah.
You said this, what's the gel radii? Let's say take gamma of 10 to the 3 or 10 to the 4. Mm-hmm. What's the gel radii compared to box size again?
So the box size, the system size limited gyro radius would be up at around 10 to the 5 in this case.
Okay.
Yeah. So these particles hit that limit.
If I go back to this formula, so I would have said just L over C is your time scale. Because the particle is just flying unperturbed through the cold box. So can you explain this extra factor of C over V? L over V is the crossing time of the L band wave, right?
L over V, yes, L over V. Well, the particles are scattered by those waves. So yes, indeed, the mean free path is just L over C, but then the amount of energy that they gain per scattering is going to be related to the velocity of the scatterers, which in this case are alphanically moving. So the factor VA squared comes from, the energy gain.
So it's many collisions that then turn to go.
Yep.
Or doubling the energy.
Yes, it's, I would say so. Lots of collisions, mainly with fluctuations at the same scale as the particle gyro radius.
How can we understand that the mean free path is always the bulk size?
That's not obvious. That's just kind of what it turns out to be.
Is it because of the k parallels to the minus 2 spectrum? So that means that delta B squared on the scales is one of the L. So if it's one at the outer scale, is that where it comes from?
It is related to that, yes. If it was not a k parallel to the minus 2 spectrum, then you would probably get energy dependence in this mean free path.
So the way you stir is you add current. Mm-hmm. Have you ever tried stirring vacuum?
No.
What happens if you stir vacuum and put dust particles into that?
That would be like a high sigma limit, I imagine. I don't know what would happen.
So there is no background with you.
If you completely take out the particles, I'm not sure what.
You mean just displacement curve?
Yeah.
So you just could do it. You just have light waves propagating around.
Exactly.
That's it.
Right. So what would happen in that case?
Yeah, I don't know.
Particles don't resonate so well.
I bet you they will accelerate.
So if your hydrogen particle only seeing 1/10 of the box to the biggest box, mm-hmm. that's in the region of your injection as well. So I don't know whether when you look at the say fluctuation on isotropy, mm-hmm. Actually it could be quite isotropic because you're kind of injecting over that range as well. So this second order gel resonance, right? So they're seeing fluctuations relatively long wavelengths, well, 1/10 of the box and upwards. Mm-hmm. So do you still expect a highly anisotropic fluctuation or kind of the full turbulence shape?
I don't
look into that.
That's a good question. I mean, it seems like we do get critical balance at those large scales, but at these scales, I don't know, maybe there are kinetic effects as well. I mean, this doesn't necessarily have to be linked to the anisotropy that much. I mean, these theories use critical balance, and if it wasn't a k to the minus 2 parallel spectrum, it would predict something differently, but I think that's still maybe not essential in this case. I don't know if that answers your question, but
we all need a 10 times more bigger box to separate the scales.
Okay, well, let me move on to the next slide. And I don't need to take too much time on this because Dmitry Uzdensky gave a KITP talk here early in the program, so you could actually see his talk online. But the bottom line here is that if we looked at the track particle statistics in the simulations, then we see that the evolution of the distribution is actually well described by a Fokker-Planck equation, which describes advection and diffusion in energy or momentum space. And this is typically how the gyroresonant acceleration is modeled. And so for the gyroresonance, you get the diffusion coefficient here and no advection coefficient. And so you expect that from gyroresonance, the diffusion coefficient to be going like gamma squared, energy squared. And this is exactly what we see in the simulations for particles in the power law range of the distribution. And there's some different scaling at low energies, which we don't fully understand at this point. But at least this range, it has the right energy scaling. It also has right coefficient to explained by this diffusive particle acceleration via gyroresonance.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
So if I think about diffusion, I see that acceleration time as a diffusion coefficient divided by the typical velocity square, which is here the alpha square. But that expression tells that the diffusion coefficient is constant, so it's energy independent. And the next slide, you're saying that the diffusion coefficient goes with energy squared. So how do I conciliate these two things?
Oh, no, it's the gamma squared. Just this part is the one over the acceleration time. And so the gamma squared isn't part of that. Does that make sense? Maybe I don't understand.
And usually write acceleration time as a diffusion coefficient divided by this, in this case, your case, B alpha squared. So you have a energy-dependent diffusion coefficient. But in your previous slide, it looks like it's an energy-independent diffusion coefficient.
No, this isn't the diffusion coefficient. This is the diffusion coefficient divided by gamma squared, inverse of that. So the gamma squared doesn't play a role in this.
Diffusion coefficient in gamma is proportional to 1 over time. Is it that gamma is unitless? So it's basically gamma squared divided by acceleration.
Right. Basically, if you put the gamma squared in here, these derivatives end up canceling the gamma squared out.
Okay.
And this is work that's been done by a grad student in Colorado, Kai Wang. Okay, so just to finish this list, so what's unknown is, what's known is the mechanism, at least seems to be consistent with these. Luca showed that magnetic reconnection might have a role in injecting particles, especially at high magnetization, and he'll talk more about that on Thursday. And unknowns are how to predict the power law index late in the simulations, what fraction of non-thermal particles, how to predict what fraction of non-thermal particles are accelerated, etc. Okay.
So if you do J dot E based on the simulation and separate them into per and parallel, are you going to show that or?
I'm going to show that for the radiative simulations.
But with all the radiation effects, which direction dominates?
A perpendicular dominates.
for all energies or for high energies?
For high energies, yeah. I guess Luca will talk more about this as well. He's done the measurements in his papers. And I'll show some slides later on this.
What about a low energy part when the things get going?
Parallel might play some role in injecting the particles there, but the overall energy gain is dominated by perpendicular fields. Okay, and so there are different future directions you could imagine going to build on this list. You could build and validate the theory. For example, predicting the distribution and the diffusion coefficients. You could add complexity like radiation, pair production, change in driving or geometry, or you could apply to model observations. And so the thing that I'll be talking about is adding radiation.
Just a question for pileups, maximal energy?
Yes, there is for driven turbulence, for decaying, not really.
But for driven, do you see?
Yeah, so the distributions I showed were taken at times before the pileup occurs, but if you would run longer, then you do get a pileup at the system, at the limit. Yeah.
Do you think that's materialistic? I mean, if the real system is always limited by the size of where you're driving, but I guess you can always escape from that.
Exactly. Normally the particles would escape in most realistic situations. So I don't think the pileup is really...
What do you expect to break then, the scale of the...
That's a great question. I think it depends. If the escape time is strongly proportional to energy, highest energies, particles are the preferential ones to escape, then I think you still get a break. Okay, so now to move on to the new stuff. So I'll be talking about radiative turbulence. So in many high-energy astrophysical systems, electrons and positrons emit plots of energy and radiation through synchrotron, inverse Compton, etc. This is something that hasn't been included in all the things that I talked about in the previous slides. So understanding the role of radiative cooling on the turbulence and particle distributions is important. And what I'll be doing is focusing on strong radiative cooling in the sense that it's of sufficient strength to balance energy from external injected energy from the driving. Okay. So key questions here. Does radiative cooling influence the turbulence cascade or the structures in the turbulence? It's not obvious that it should. I mean, it takes energy out of the cascade, but that would at small scales, so that's one question. Does the system attain a steady state? You could imagine a setup where the amount of energy you're injecting is balanced by the amount you're radiating, and so you could get an equilibrium temperature for the plasma in this case. That's one very interesting feature of this that I'll be describing. How does radiative cooling influence non-thermal particle distribution? So I showed you all these plots of non-thermal particle acceleration. If you add radiative cooling, what happens to those non-thermal particles? And are there any observable radiative signatures of this, like spectra, spectral features, or beams of particles, etc.? So these are the kinds of questions I'll be asking for radiative turbulence. The way we implement radiation is very simple. It only takes half a slide to explain this. What I'm going to be describing is external inverse Compton cooling. And the way we add this is by including a radiation reaction force added to the Lorentz force of the particles acting on relativistic electrons and positrons. And it looks like this. You have a Thomson cross-section, you have an external photon energy density, and it's proportional to energy squared of the particles. Okay, and so that's what the radiation reaction looks like. And so we assume that there's a uniform constant bath of external photons, which are at low energy, and so this UPH parameter is just uniform in space and time. And optically thin medium, so radiation just escapes the box. Okay, so you could estimate what a...
You don't have to do any Monte Carlo. You just stick that in there and go.
Exactly. It's very simple. It's like just a drag force on the particles. A very simplest thing you could do. So the nice thing about this is you could very easily predict what the radiative steady state temperature should be. So first of all, both species are radiating here, so you could easily imagine a statistical steady state in the care of a case of a pair plasma. The energy injection rate from the external driving is like the energy density divided by the cascade time, which will be given by this expression here, assuming a turbulent field is comparable to the background field. Then the radiative energy loss rate will be just from integrating that force over all the particles. And this goes like temperature squared and photon energy density. And this assumes something close to a thermal distribution. And if you just set these to be equal to each other, then you could solve for the temperature and you get this expression right here. Temperature in terms of the magnetization and some other parameters related to the photon energy density. And this gives you the energy to expect particles to have for a given photon energy density. And so somewhat arbitrarily, we just choose the photon energy density in the simulations to give us a gamma bar of 300 or temperature of 100, a theta of 100. Okay, so that's the setup we're considering. Here's just the details on the numerics. So we're using a 3D PIC code Zeltron, periodic cubic box, so there's no particle escape. We initialize a thermal plasma. We apply large-scale driving through an oscillating Langevin antenna, which is just an external current density acting on large-scale modes in the plasma. And then we have a uniform background field, which is comparable to the turbulent field. And this is pointing in the Z direction in the simulations. We first consider relativistic pair plasmas. As I mentioned, we set the temperature close to 100, which is near the steady state, the expected steady state temperature. And then we have two physical parameters, the magnetization, which I already mentioned. It determines how relativistic the turbulence is, and the system size, just the size of the box or the driving scale relative to the gyro radius of the particles. We do a parameter scan of the simulations in values of system size and the magnetization. And simulations look something like this. So there's a three-dimensional visual of the simulation. Here are current densities in a slice of the simulation. You see lots of current sheets develop, both at the low sigma and at the high sigma cases. And so lots of structure there. Some more pictures. Here are the energy densities at low sigma and at high sigma, and the particle density fluctuations at low sigma and high sigma. And so this is just saying it looks basically like what you expect. It's very turbulent.
Since you've done lots of UHD simulations as well, if you plot the current like you had on the previous slide in an UHD simulation, does it look like this, or does this look sharp?
I would say so. I mean, yeah, I would say it looks pretty similar. This is, of course, much noisier than MHD. I would say this looks pretty similar apart from the noise to MHD. This, I don't know, maybe it's a bit more intermittent. I don't know. That's hard to say. This you would probably want to compare with force-free MHD, which I don't really know exactly what that looks like.
I think it's the top and the bottom, it's a different sigma.
Yeah, just different sigmas, sigma of 3 and sigma of 1/5.
Why is it so a little much more noisier? Or is it better? Looks noisier.
Yes, this low sigma is high beta, and so It tends to be very noisy there because the energies are dominated by the thermal energy of the particles, and so the fluctuations are kind of a small perturbation on top of the thermal population, and so the peak noise really gets amplified there. With more particles, it would look less noisy, but we can't afford.
But does it become more resistant because it's noisy?
Yeah, and I mean, again, we could change this with particles per cell, and it seems converged in that sense. So I wouldn't say numerical collisions play any role, if that's what you're asking.
Remind us, how do you change sigma between simulations?
Okay, so that's, yeah, so sigma, I have to think about this. It's basically by adjusting the density of the plasma. So we choose the magnetic field to set the gyro radius of the particles, and then we set the density to set the magnetization.
So should I think of this having the same magnetic field strength, but having different densities in it?
Yeah.
You are changing beta along the way, or you keep the temperature.
Yes, so in all of these cases, beta is like 1 over sigma. And so I could just plot, instead of sigma, I could just put 1 over beta here. Yeah. So high sigma is low beta, low sigma is high beta. Okay, so here we confirm that the plasma reaches a steady state. This shows three different simulations starting at different temperatures, but having the same other parameters, and then they reach a steady state temperature, which agrees with the predictions. And this shows the steady state temperature versus different sigma. We scan sigma over a factor of about 100. And it seems they all lie very close, within 50% or so of the theoretical estimate. So we do get the steady state that we predicted.
Does this steady state level depend on your injection rate?
Yes, I suppose it would, although we haven't directly tried that. Yeah.
It's an interesting thing to see. I mean, it should.
Mm-hmm. This is what the steady state energetics look like. So here's an example of sigma close to 1. We have internal energy, electric energy in blue. Then we have turbulent magnetic and kinetic energies here in red and green. And so you see over 30 alphane times, energies just fluctuate in the steady state. You could run it forever like this. This is a steady state energy versus the magnetization. At low magnetization, the plasma is dominated by the internal energy. And what this ends up meaning is that the bulk flows are subrelativistic, as you expect. And this just looks like classical MHD, like non-relativistic and compressible MHD in many ways. Okay, then when you go to high sigma, it becomes dominated by turbulent magnetic and electric energies, so it's electromagnetically dominated, and you end up getting relativistic flows in that case. And this is like a force-free electrodynamics or force-free MHD regime, which has been studied with fluid codes before. Here are some turbulent spectra. I won't really describe these in detail, but we do see something with larger system sizes. It seems to converge to a 5/3 spectrum, as we expect, both for the magnetic energy and for the density. And with the sigma scan, changing magnetization, we see something close to 5/3 for the low sigma cases, and then maybe something steeper, not really a power law for high sigma cases. And there's a lot that could be going on at high sigma. It's relativistic, so it also becomes highly compressible. But overall, it looks close to MHD expectations.
At high sigma.
SRE.
It's kind of compressible, you said?
Yeah.
I see.
Yep. I think it does.
Because I assume plasmas are usually less compressible.
Why less compressible?
Magnetic field is hard to squeeze.
Low signal ones, the thin one.
When?
In the low signal one, the thin one, you would be out of the squeeze, right?
Well, he's
not your mark.
He's still the B's large.
When?
He's still the B's large.
Yeah, I would say the plasma reacts very strongly at high sigma to small perturbations in magnetic field, and so that's what causes strong.
So if you try to make a shock, its compression ratio will be very small, like in high sigma. That's why people
use pressure balance. But here, so I suspect you even have PDI in it, but that's a different story. But you're driving a lot of compressible modes.
I mean, any change in magnetic field can easily create this.
Well, basically, it runs away from you. At high sigma, the reason why you can't make a strong shock at high sigma is because the signal speed is speed of light. So no matter how hard you try to shake it, it runs away from you at the speed of light.
Yeah,
it's really hard to compress. So. Well, so
it's probably harder for him to generate incompressible magnetic turbulence in this system.
Exactly.
Well, at high sigma, I would say, yeah, it's difficult. I mean, we do see shock-like structures, but I don't know really how efficient they are at particle acceleration, et cetera. Yeah.
Maybe you have regions of low sigma where you have turn sheets, and that's what you call incompressible.
I don't know.
Is high density anti-correlated with high B?
Typically, yes. Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so then maybe I withdraw my objection, because then the high density is where your current sheets are. I just would be very surprised if you could compress high sigma flow.
Okay, well.
So it's a specific relativistic thing. This is specific relativistic thing, because it won't run the lights.
Mm-hmm. You just can't make sure.
Well, Solomon has pressure balance structures.
But it's not relativistic.
Yeah, which has this undercorrelation as well.
Okay.
Well, what happens to your kinetic cascade then? Because it seems like minus six.
Yes. What happened to the kinetic cascade? It was minus four before, now it's minus six. Well, it's not really resolved here. I wouldn't trust that index at all, really. It does typically seem to be steeper than minus four in these runs. And the broader you make this range, the steeper it gets. But I mean, this minus six is just fit by the eye. I don't think it really means anything. You could get something close to minus four by adjusting the kinetic scale separation. It's just completely unresolved in these simulations.
The lower is different sigma, right?
Yeah, that's a sigma scan. Yep.
Are these lower resolution than your non-additive simulation?
They tend to be smaller boxes, yeah, so 512 cubed, 768 cubed, so they're a bit lower.
Might that be related to the different indices in the kinetic range?
No, the kinetic range doesn't really care about the system size too much. That's pretty robust, both in the non-radiative and radiative cases. Well, okay, I guess you're asking about the resolution with respect to rho e, for example. It could be related to that. Yeah,
I was thinking that this question about high sigma compressibility is dependent upon the geometry of the field. So when you are a non-relativistic, basic, well, assuming that plasma is frozen, magnetic field is frozen plasma, then you can just have the equation state heat is proportional to rho to some gamma. No relativistic gamma is 5/3. Relativistic fluids, gamma 4/3. But when you have the magnetic field, which is like in your case, with a shock, then when the field is actually oriented and across the field, gamma squared, I mean rho squared. So it becomes, it's steeper than the relativistic. But so basically, yes. So with the ordered field, you have less compressibility. But in the tangent field, with all trivial fields being having equal orientation in statistical sense, then it's 4/3 like a relativistic fluid. So it basically, I think this question is more subtle than just saying, well, high sigma.
Do you get zeros? Do you get zeros of magnitude? I mean, the question is density overall.
Right, if you consider this as a statistical ensemble and I'm just compressing the box with full isotropic turbulence, I'll have sigma of, the derivative index of 4/3. Whereas if I put like in the shock, field in a given direction, they're going to compress it ridiculously. The field is going to be rho squared, so gamma is 2. So maybe what you were saying, Lavin, is kind of make sense. Because, well, yes, when you go to high sigma and tangential fields, then you're approaching the 4/3 limit, which is kind of a lower compressibility. I mean, a higher compressibility, lower stiffness.
Question is if B and density are correlated or anti-correlated.
Well,
that's a good one, yeah.
Generally, yes.
So is it correlated or is it anti-correlated? It's frozen then, it should be correlated.
It tends to be anti-correlated. At least for the low sigma cases. I'm not sure about high sigma. That, yeah, could look at that in more detail.
There's pressure balance.
But at high sigma, it won't be able to manage pressure balance. Sorry, what is it? At high sigma, it won't be able to manage pressure balance anymore. So maybe you don't expect any correlation.
We should look at it.
This actually looks quite similar to like non-relativistic MHT simulations if you would just replace beta with sigma.
Exactly, yeah. So this high sigma density spectrum is quite similar to supersonic MHT.
Yeah, yeah. And then it gets steeper as you go down in beta and it becomes closer to being incompressible.
Yeah, so that's definitely a connection there. Okay, how much time do I have?
Our next event is at 3 p.m.
Okay, so getting to the particle statistics, one difference we see, which is quite drastic compared to the non-radiative simulations, is that the steady-state particle distributions are very close to thermal. So the non-thermal tail, which would extend off of the plot here in the non-radiative case, is completely gone in this radiative case. And so we see quasi-thermal distributions, and this is for all values of sigma. It's quite robust. Power law is quenched by cooling, and this has been anticipated by some analytic works, like by Schlickheiser, and I'll go into more detail on that in the next slide. Just showing here, there is, if we decompose the distribution into thermal and non-thermal parts, we do see there is a bulge, a non-thermal bulge there, and it actually could have a significant amount of energy, like tens of percent of energy in the high sigma case, but it just doesn't extend very much in energy. It's very narrow, just a factor of two in energy. So there are non-thermal particles, but they don't have very high energies. And so why does this happen? Well, you could actually explain a lot just by going back to the stochastic particle acceleration model. So here, as I showed earlier, is the Fokker-Planck equation, which describes the diffusive particle acceleration. And here I've added a cooling term due to the radiation, which just goes like gamma squared. It's like another advection term. If you assume that there's some second order Fermi process, you could imagine a diffusion coefficient which goes like some constant plus energy squared, just a very simple form, quadratic and energy. And the advection coefficient from maybe possible first order Fermi processes is just proportional to energy. And then we also stick in a constant there to explain uniform heating, which might be also occurring. Okay, so if we assume those diffusion and advection coefficients, we could derive an analytic steady state solution just at DTF equals zero, integrate that out, and you end up getting this really ugly solution with four free parameters, these different gammas, which are just the cooling time scale relative to the time scale of that specific term in the advection or diffusion coefficient. Okay, so the important thing here is that this is like an exponential decline plus some arctan term, so the arctan term doesn't really do much overall. This basically looks like a thermal distribution in almost all cases. And in fact, you recover the Maxwell-Eutner relativistic thermal distribution if you just have diffusion alone. So you set all these parameters to zero except for gamma 2, which is that gamma squared coefficient. Then you just get the thermal distribution. And everything else is a slight correction to that. So how does this solution compare to the simulations? Well, with different free parameters, we're able to get good fits in all of the cases, low sigma, moderate sigma, and high sigma. And in all of these fits, I assumed scattering by Alphane modes. So it's the same acceleration time for the diffusion coefficient as I showed earlier in the talk for the non-radiative cases. So that was just held fixed. There's no ambiguity there. And then the other three parameters are just chosen by hand, and then they're listed here. This just shows that you could, this is not inconsistent with there being particle acceleration. It's just the particle acceleration is competing with a radiative cooling, and you end up thermalizing everything because of that. Incidentally, the best fit parameters imply a first order deceleration process, which is a bit strange, so that term ends up being negative. And we're looking into what might be the physical reason for that. Right now, we don't know.
Sorry, wouldn't cooling result in deceleration?
Well, the radiative cooling would be another term. So this is on top of the radiative cooling. You have some kind of other physical effect, which is cooling the plasma. So like some kind of drag or something on the high energy particles.
Well, I thought in the Fokker plotting, the D and the A are actually somewhat related, but you're treating it as a separate?
It depends on how you write out the equation. So if you expand out the D, then you also could get an A. But the way I write it out, this D is the only term you would get from the diffusive particle acceleration, like the typical gyroresonant theories.
Been so long, so you somehow separate out part of the diffusion process, only call it one coefficient, the gap tau 2, and then you invoke some other physics.
Yeah, everything except for tau 2 is other physics, which has no model. I mean, no theory for it at all. It's just convenient terms.
So in a sense, you added a term as first order in,
Exactly.
So how should we think about the advection? If you say advection coefficient is the first order Fermi here, is that what becomes negative when you say?
Yeah, that? So that term becomes negative. Our fits imply that term is negative.
And how does that term look like in the non-radiative case?
In the non-radiative case, it also turns out to be negative, actually, but it's close to zero. It's negative. And that paper by Kai Wang just measures the advection coefficient there. Okay, so that's the energy distribution. The other thing that's interesting is the anisotropy of the distribution. So in addition to the energy distribution, we could look at the anisotropy of the momentum distribution. This is interesting because outgoing radiation is beamed in direction of particle anisotropy. So if more particles are heading in one direction, then get more radiation in that direction. So we are going to be looking at this conditional momentum anisotropy distribution. So this is just, you have two angles in here, theta phi, which are the polar and azimuthal angles with respect to the background field. And then you're integrating the energies over some range in particle energies and then seeing what that looks like in angles. If you just plot this versus the angle relative to the background field, then you see that the low-energy particles of gamma less than 800 are basically insensitive of that angle. They're isotropic. But the high-energy particles, they become beamed in directions which end up being perpendicular to the background field, especially for the high sigma cases. So there is some anisotropy for high-energy particles. And looking at this in more detail, these are just showing different times in the simulation, and each of these is showing a sphere, and it's showing low energy, the number of low energy particles going in those directions on the sphere. So the distribution of angles that the particles are going in. What you see here for the low energy particles are just these, it's overall, to first approximation, it's just uniform. But then on top of that, you do see some structure due to large-scale bulk flows of the particles. So particles tend to be moving coherently at large scales due to the bulk flows. And this changes in time because of random driving, and it doesn't have any particular direction. But then when you look at the high-energy particles instead, you see a different story. These are the same times, and you see much different structures here. You still see some bulk flows in the high-energy particles, but then you also see other times when there are lots of small-scale beams. They're kinetic beams associated with structures within the turbulence. So high-energy particles are being accelerated in the turbulence, and they're leading to these coherent beams going in certain angles. This is integrated over the whole box, so it's not looking locally. It's like, yeah, over the whole box. So this is for, also I should mention, this is for the high sigma cases. For the low sigma cases, we don't see so much beaming. Here's animation of how this evolves in time. Time relative to the Alpian crossing times is shown on the right. So these beams come in and out relatively rapidly compared to that crossing time, and some of them could be quite intense. It's basically just showing structures evolving in the turbulence.
What exactly do you mean by averaging over the whole bulk? Each cell has a theta and phi, right?
Yeah.
So you say the particle that points that particular theta and phi, you make a contribution to this.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So it could, one hotspot could come from very different cells. Is that what you mean?
Exactly, yeah. So this is for all particles in the simulation, and some population of those particles happen to be beamed in particular directions.
So it could be that if you look at one of those beams at any given time, it could almost all be coming from one particular cell in your simulation.
One cell or one structure anyway.
Yeah, but that seems unlikely because then the direction was making sense.
Yeah.
If you had the whole cell in a uniform or the whole grid in a uniform direction, but like all in the same direction, it would just show up as like a delta function on this map, right? Or am I?
It would be Yeah, a delta function, yeah, that's
this
right.
It's basically a 2D histogram in theta and phi.
Yep.
Yeah,
that's right.
Which way is B0?
So guide field would be in the vertical direction. And so, I mean, if you look at this again, you could see most of these structures are perpendicular to the guide field. And that's not just the projection effect. They actually are beamed perpendicular to the guide field.
Because that's the authentic energy flux is going in that direction. I mean, the bulk flow is going in that direction. Is there authentic motions?
Yes, that's part of it, yes. And then also, I'll show that also the energization mechanism is perpendicular to the guide fields. So
technically, you can compute d mu mu as well, which you probably have done now. Do they satisfy second order expectation as well that has a much faster rate?
That's a good question. We haven't looked at that in the radiative cases, actually. We looked at it in the non-radiative cases, and that seemed to evolve in time, so it wasn't very well conserved, at least over, you know, alphanic time scales. For the radiative cases, I'm not sure. I haven't looked at that. Looking at one of these beaming events in detail, so this is showing one of those 2D histograms at a particular direction, which coincides with a strong beam, which is shown here on the bottom part. And so you could see, first of all, the low energy particles are shown in blue, and then these only fluctuate, you know, by a factor of 2 in time. So those are the effects from the bulk flows. But then for the high energy particles shown in red, you see the measurement is very intermittent. You tend to get these very rapid spikes of particles going along the line of sight there. And in particular, this is the beam shown down here. It's a very strong event where you get a factor of 40 more particles going in that direction than normal. Okay, so this is showing you do get very strong beams in the turbulence. And it's actually reflected in the global energy distribution. You see blue is a time before the beaming, then you get a bit of a tail there during the beam, and then that dies away after the beam. So you do get, this is reflected in the distribution. As far as the mechanism of beaming, we think it's related to magnetic reconnection, and that's explained in this plot. So I'm showing a couple things here. So in green, I'm showing contours of where the high energy particles are located in the box. And then in red, I'm showing the plasma heating rate, the E dot J on the left, and then the current density on the right. And they seem to be pretty strongly correlated. And in particular, you see that a lot of these high energy particles, which are responsible for the beams, are localized in the current sheets. So it seems natural to correlate them with the intermittent magnetic reconnection, those structures.
So in the previous turbulence, did you have the same correlation? Or is this, like, is this the simulation we've seen before? Or is this some other simulation?
That's a good question.
Like when you're talking about diffusion of particles and applying all of these, did you actually have all of these particles concentrated in current sheets?
To be fair, we haven't really done this exact same measurement in the non-radiative case, but my sense is that in the non-radiative case, the high energy particles just diffuse very rapidly over around the box, so that after a short amount of time, they're not really correlated with structures anymore.
But in the radiative case, yeah.
In the radiative case, they are. And
because they never get to high energy?
Well, because as soon as they leave the structure which is accelerating them, they're cooled, and they go back to have an average energy.
But is it fair to say that in the other case, the uncooled one, that most of the acceleration was still happening in this current sheet? Or is it more diffuse?
We've looked for a correlation there. It seems to be more diffusive.
The gel radii is pretty big. did you calculate generator for 1,000, gamma 1,000?
I mean, in these cases, I mean, it's quasi-thermal, so it's a very small gyro radii, but in the non-radiative case, yeah, it would be very big gyro radii, so that...
Yeah, so it's hard to...
Yeah, the particles would probably stop interacting with these kinds of structures in any case. The other thing I should mention is for the non-radiative cases, we can't really sustain the high sigma because sigma drops in time and then becomes order unity after turnover time. This is maintaining high sigma, and I think the high sigma is important for these beaming effects.
Should we interpret this then as like the mechanism that injects it into the diffusive process in the non-radiative simulation? Gets it up to high enough energy so that you can get this Fermi acceleration?
Yes. Let me show the next slide because I think that answers your question. So this is showing the work done on a tracked particle by parallel and perpendicular electric fields. And we see that most of the energy gain is from perpendicular fields, shown in red here. But then we also have some contribution from parallel electric fields, shown in blue here. In particular, you see that whenever there's a very strong acceleration event in the simulation, it tends to be preceded by a little kick by the parallel electric field. And so indeed, it looks like these current sheets might be injecting particles to energies where then they're interacting with the ideal fields. And they could be kicked up by a lot of energy by those ideal fields, and that's what's actually beaming them. And this is exactly what Lucas sees in the in his non-radiative simulation, so it's consistent with his ideas there.
Can you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Sorry, how much more do we have?
It's just, let's see. That's going to be the last slide, I think.
Yeah. So I'm a little confused. I mean, you're saying that the high-energy particles are in the current sheets, but like, if you look at like things that Jim Drake's been talking about, I mean, the curvature drift acceleration is actually happening out in the islands in the exhaust regions. It's not happening in the current sheets. So you wouldn't expect, if that were the mechanism, that you'd have a lot of high energy particles right there inside the current sheets.
That's a good point.
Yeah, but you have to be careful because as you go in towards the current sheet, the curvature of the field gets very strong. And so you do have a lot of curvature drift in that region.
Right. So these are paraplasmas, so it's a little weird to think about.
Well, no, but still.
Well, right. And I mean, the other thing here, I think, is once the particles get into the exhausts, maybe they become strongly cooled and they can't really maintain high energies after.
So this is what we typically find. This is high guide fuel reconnection, if reconnection is playing a role. Because, you're right, as you know, this is a little, just a little twist. And because the mean background B0 is very, very strong. So, like what Jim was saying yesterday, when the guide field becomes very, very strong, the Fermi contribution becomes small.
Yeah, but look at his next slide.
So something else is going on, is what I'm trying to say.
So there's a couple of things that are interesting. First of all, so the perpendicular is really have these big jumps. And so that's got to be curvature drift or something like that. But the other thing about this, it seems to me, is that this doesn't look like second order. It looks like first order. So, I mean, are you still arguing that all this acceleration stuff and for this type of simulation is second order?
I would say so, based on the Fokker-Planck modeling that we've done. And the first order term, it leads to cooling if that model is correct. So that's a good point.
I mean, is this trace typical, or is this a highly unusual particle?
It's typical. I would say it's typical.
But then it doesn't look like second order. It looks like first order.
I don't know. It might be a good point.
So if you have converging flows, right, which you do in the connection, and if you have large enough Larmor radius particle, it can just sit between these two converging flows. It will gain energy like that.
Some people argue such a theory, yes.
I've never seen them. but maybe this is, maybe you find
this. So this is not directly from the reconnection, it's actually the
well, it's still mapping the electric field of reconnection.
But I mean, look, he can, in principle, he's got the data. You could look at this and see what the magnetic geometry is.
Well, what is the y-axis? Delta gamma over gamma.
So delta gamma is just, without including the radiative losses, how much energy the particle would have gained without those radiative losses. So it's like the work done by the electric fields on the particles. And actually, the radiative losses are shown in green, and then you can see it kind of tracks the same evolution there. So
mean gamma is also evolving with time?
No, it's in a steady state. So on average, okay, so that's actually the last slide. I mean, I had stuff on radiative electron ion turbulence, but I don't think we need to go over that. So I'll just jump to the conclusions. Okay. Just to remind you the results, so statistical steady state in a pair plasma exists, and I didn't talk about electron ion plasma, so ignore that. Radiative cooling thermalizes the plasma, leading to these quasi-thermal distributions, which is what you expect given these diffusive acceleration models. And at high magnetization, high energy particles are intermittently beamed, evidently due to magnetic reconnection in the current sheets. And that may explain rapid flares in systems like laser jets or accretion flows. And papers on archive. Okay, thanks.
So the cooling, that was the, the form is similar to synchrotron cooling, right?
Yep.
Normally, I expect breaks in power laws when I see some differences. Why do you get a Maxwellian?
Well, because it's a strong cooling case. So it's just unique to the steady state situation. If we were to do weaker cooling where it's not a steady state, where it's somewhere between the non-radiative cases and the strongly cooled cases here, I think you would see a cutoff in the power law caused by the cooling in that case. That's just not the setup we've looked at for this paper.
But if you have strong cooling, you just the break just moves through. It doesn't become a Maxwellian. Is there something special about this setup?
You mean the break moves through from high energies to low energies? Yeah, basically in this setup, we'd be imagining the case where that break just moves to thermal energies and then stops there.
But that doesn't make the question.
It happens to. I mean, just by coincidence, that's what this Fokker-Planck model is showing, basically. If you have the diffusive acceleration and it's balanced by the rate of cooling, it happens to be Maxwell-Eutner just by coincidence, I guess. Yeah.
Just want to, we should talk, and I'm just curious how this correlates with what people normally do.
If the cooling didn't go like gamma squared, then you wouldn't get a thermal distribution, you'd get something different.
Cooling like gamma squared is normal, right?
Yeah, it's normal.
No, that happens in synchrotron case as well. Mm-hmm. So I'm surprised, well, we should talk. I'm disconnected or something.
When you calculate your detection coefficient from the particle trajectories, I guess, you take into account everything because you already have this drag force from the cooling. Mm-hmm. So, could you be counting cooling twice? I mean,
No, because the cool. Yeah, we're including the cooling separately, so that's measured separately.
So when. So how do you calculate the detection coefficient from the evolution of the particles?
It's from the collision?
From the evolution of the particle. I mean,
it's all from the, what I showed was not from tracked particles. So that was just plugging in terms into a Fokker-Planck equation and looking at the steady state. The stuff that I showed earlier in the talk on the non-radiative case, that was from the tracked particles and seeing them. So we actually haven't done that tracked particle analysis directly measuring the diffusion and advection coefficients for the radiative cases. This was just modeling it, which is a little bit simpler.
And if you do that, the cooling will be there already because you're already putting the back force on.
Yeah, and so you'd have to account for that when you're measuring these coefficients.
Can you show a plot from number two then? Of the electron line operating?
I think it would.
That's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I think it would
just
take too much time to explain.
But
what happens in the electron ion case, this is what the temperature ratio looks like. So the ions are not radiating, the electrons are radiating. We start at a temperature ratio of 1, which looks like 0 here. And then it grows to 300 or so. And so we don't see anything preventing that from growing. So there's no steady state in the electron ion case.
Because the ions are just not radiating?
Yeah, the ions aren't radiating, so energy goes into them, they keep getting heated up.
The electrons are at constant temperature?
The electrons actually reach a constant temperature, that's right. And they gain about like 10% of the injected energy or so, around that amount.
Thank you very much.